بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله وسلم وبارك على سيدنا ومولانا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. اللهم علمنا ما ينفعنا وانفعنا بما علمتنا وزدنا من فضلك علما وتعليما، إنك على كل شيء قدير. أما بعد، الحمد لله. Just an announcement. We're going to have Isha at 9:15 inshallah instead of 9 o'clock, just so we can finish this class bi-idhnillah. This is the final lesson in module 3 in the Fard Ain course, in which we cover the fiqh of fasting. And last week we looked at some new terms. We talked about the different Sharia rulings before, and we introduced some new terms that are used particularly within the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, things that distinguish between fard and wajib and things like that. And on that basis, we talked about the different kinds of fasts, those that are fard, those that are wajib, those that are recommended, those that are voluntary, and so on. And we talked about on whom fasting is obligatory. And we talked about issues related to the sighting of the moon. In last week's class, there was a lot of theory in the beginning, talking about the distinction between fard and wajib, and between makruh tahrimi and makruh tanzihi, and how the school of Imam Abu Hanifa classified these things based on whether those issues are coming from what is clear-cut in transmission and decisive in indication. We're not going to rehash all of that. That's so we understand the terminology being used. In tonight's class, inshallah, we're going to be looking at the actual fiqh of fasting. Now, who remembers from last week, we defined fasting and we said that it has a very basic linguistic meaning in the Arabic language. Who remembers that basic Arabic meaning? Yes. Imsak. Mutlaqul imsak. Basically withholding or abstaining in an absolute sense. When we look at fasting, it's a very special act of worship, because if someone asks you while you're fasting, right? You say yes. Well, what do you do when you're fasting? What are you doing? It's an amal, it's an action. It's a pillar of Islam. But when you're fasting, what exactly are you doing? You're doing nothing. That's the issue. It's imsak. It's an act of worship where outwardly there's movement, right? You're doing things in the world. You're studying. You're going to work. You're dealing with your kids. Inwardly, there's a kind of stillness because you are withholding yourself from taking into your body the things you normally take in on a day-to-day basis. So tonight, inshallah, we want to look at the ins and outs of how we fast. Now, fasting is not a complicated process. And inshallah, if we adhere to just the very basic definition, we won't really have to deal with a lot of the issues we're learning tonight. But tonight, inshallah, we cover the issue of intention, the intention we have in fasting, whether it's Ramadan or other kinds of fast. We look at the things that break the fast and their categories, because they're not all the same, the muftirat. We want to look at what doesn't break the fast, because a lot of people think, well, this thing breaks my fast, and it doesn't. Or they worry, does this break my fast, and it might or might not. We also want to look at what is disliked while fasting. What shouldn't we be doing while fasting, even though doing that thing doesn't break your fast? We want to look at what is fidya, which is a kind of penalty payment. Also miscellaneous issues in fasting. These are the various issues that come up that people often ask about in day-to-day life. And we'll take a look at i'tikaf, the retreat within the masjid. And lastly, very briefly, the spiritual dimensions of fasting. So if we go back to this definition that I provided last week, we mentioned the linguistic meaning, of unconditional restraint, imsak, we want to look at the definition of fasting according to Sharia, the technical meaning, which consists of six things. If you hold fast to these six things and you understand this, well, we can make this the final slide for tonight and then we can have refreshments. However, things come up. People have issues, and so there's questions to be answered. This definition mentions six things. Number one, refraining from entering anything into the body cavity, whether deliberately or accidentally, or engaging in intercourse, from true dawn to the time the sun sets, accompanied with the intention of fasting from individuals who are permitted to fast. This is the ta'arif. And the ta'arif, the definition, is very comprehensive. It includes everything that makes siyam, siyam. And it excludes what is not siyam. So we see six things here, and we'll look at them individually. We'll start first with the intention. Now we know that fasting is not eating and drinking and engaging in intercourse from the time of the Fajr until Maghrib with the intention to do so. That's the basic meaning of fasting. And if that's what you hold to and nothing else happens, then inshallah you're good. Your Ramadan will be, idhnillah, be accepted. But there are issues that come up. So let's start from the intention, because that's coming before the act of fasting. And we'll go through the different meanings within this definition. The intention is really important because, as you all know, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "Innama al-a'malu bin-niyyat wa innama likulli imrin ma nawa." Actions are governed by their intentions, and a person will only have what they intended. If you wake up in the morning, what's the first meal of the day? What's it called? Breakfast. Why do we call it breakfast? Because you're breaking your fast. Were you breaking siyam this morning? For those of you who weren't fasting, you had breakfast. You were breaking your fast. But it wasn't a fast according to the shar'i meaning. It was a linguistic fast, which was imsak. You just didn't have food. You didn't have anything to drink. You woke up, and maybe you're into intermittent fasting, so you exercise and then you eat at 10 in the morning. But that wasn't a legal shar'i fast. Why? Because it lacked something. It lacked intention, right? And also, if you made that intention and broke it at breakfast, you'd have a problem there. You need to make that up. But the point I'm making is the niyya is what separates mundane, ordinary activities from acts of worship. So you have to have the niyya. A lot of people get confused about the niyya and what it entails. And it's not something you should really worry so much about, because everyone forms a niyya, and they don't even need to say it out loud. They form the niyya because they have an intention. When you get up in the morning for Fajr and you go into your bathroom area and you start making wudu, if someone was to stop you and say, "What are you doing?" you would say, "I'm making wudu." And if they asked you, "What for?" you would say, "For salat." It's very obvious, because you're only getting up to make wudu because you have an intention to pray. And that's a condition of salat, to have wudu. So the intention is really just this determination to do something. You've decided in your mind, in your heart, "I am going to do this thing." Right? That's a niyya. You don't have to say the niyya. You could, but you don't have to say it, because you know exactly what you're doing. Let's say you get up at 3:45 or 4 in the morning and you're cooking eggs and you're eating, and someone comes downstairs and says, "Well, what are you doing?" You say, "I'm eating suhoor." "Well, why are you eating suhoor?" "Because I intend to fast." So you already had the niyya there, and your external action simply demonstrated that was your prior niyya. Your intention was already there. So it's just the determination in the heart. You don't have to verbalize it. So the purpose of the niyyah is to distinguish what you're doing from ordinary actions. So maybe you like to get up at 3:45 in the morning on every day of the week, and you like to You're that kind of person. Well, what distinguishes suhoor from eating that early in the morning? It's the niyyah, because you intend to fast. So niyyah is required for every act of worship. It's required for every kind of fast. And the purpose is to distinguish that act from other mundane things. In the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, they look at the niyyah in a very particular way. And they mention that there's two types of intentions. Well, two aspects to, or you could say, depending on the type of fast you're doing, the intention will look a certain way. So you have fasts that require a niyyah, where you have a determination in your heart, and it requires that you specify what kind of fast you're doing. And you have to form that niyyah at night, tabiyyatun niyyah, which is before Fajr comes in. So you have to have a determination in your heart, I am fasting for the sake of Allah, and it's this kind of fast, and it has to be formed before Fajr comes in. That's the first kind of niyyah in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa. And this is the niyyah you would use when you are making up fast from prior Ramadans, or when you're making up broken fasts that were voluntary, or if you are doing the kafara, the expiation for previous fast, or for vows that were unspecified. Like, let's say you made a vow to Allah. You said, I swear by Allah, I will fast 3 days if I get this job or I get this promotion. You didn't say when you'd fast those days. You just said, if I get this job or promotion, I'll fast 3 days. You get the promotion. So you decide 3 months later, okay, I'm going to fast those 3 days to fulfill my vow. According to Imam Abu Hanifa, that kind of fast requires that you have the intention and you specify what kind of fast it is. It's for the vow. And you form that niyyah before Fajr comes in. The same thing for the missed Ramadan fast you're making up, the broken voluntary fast, and expiations. So they call this tabiyyatun niyyah, and the idea is you're not forming a niyyah after Fajr has come in, right? The second kind doesn't require that tabiyyatun niyyah of having it before Fajr. You still have to have the intention, the determination to do the act for the sake of Allah. You have to specify what it is to distinguish it from other types, but you don't have to have it formed in your heart, that determination, before Fajr comes in. So this would include the current Ramadan fast, specific vowed fast where you've already chosen the day for it, and voluntary fast. So for these, you don't have to specify the niyyah before Fajr comes in. Let's say it's Ramadan and you go home very late after Taraweeh, and let's say your alarm doesn't go off and you miss Suhoor, and you wake up and it's 20 minutes before sunrise, right? Did you formulate the niyyah before Fajr? You didn't. You didn't have this tabiyyatun niyyah. But can you fast? Yes, because the Ramadan is already a specified fast for the entire month. So you already know what you're doing the night before, as opposed to an open-ended fast where you fulfill a vow and you didn't pick the day, right? If you pick the day, or if you're making up something specific from the past, you need to have the niyyah before Fajr. Same for voluntary fast or specified vowed fast. You need to have the niyyah the specification. But if Fajr comes in and you didn't form it, you're okay. Now, for most people, this is never going to be an issue, because most people have the niyyah before they go to bed. They know exactly what they're going to do in the morning. So they don't really need this. Where this might come in handy for some people is if they wake up one morning, they went to bed with no intention of fasting, and they wake up one morning, they pray Fajr, they haven't eaten, they haven't consumed any liquids, and maybe at a time like 9 in the morning or 10, they decide, you know what, I don't have any food in the house, or I didn't eat anything, I'm going to go ahead and make today a voluntary fast. So they're specifying the intention that it's voluntary for the sake of Allah, but the intention is formed after Fajr. As long as they didn't do anything that would normally break the fast, they can maintain that through the day, and at Maghrib time, they've done a voluntary fast, and it's accepted, inshallah. So this is good for those situations if you decide all of a sudden to fast a voluntary fast. For your current Ramadan or making up past days, really in experience, it's hard to even do this because most people know exactly what they're doing the night before. Even if they wake up late for Sahur, they know already what they were planning on doing, which is to fast. So this is a distinction made within the school that most people don't really have to contend with. So the first type, you need to make the intention in your heart for the specific fast, the night before the fast starts, meaning up until Fajr. The second type is you make an intention in the heart for the specific fast, the night before the fast starts, preferably, or at the latest by the Islamic midday, al-dahwatul kubra, provided you have not engaged in any of the muftirat, the things that break the fast. So what that means is if you're doing a voluntary fast or any of these in category 2, A, B, and C, you can form the niyyah up until a certain point in the day. I mean, you can't go up until 6 o'clock at night and say, oh, okay, actually, no, I'm going to make an intention to fast starting from now. And you didn't eat anything that entire day. No. You have to form the intention by at least the Islamic midday. Now, when is that? The Islamic midday is a very specific point of time called al-dahwatul kubra. And the ulama, they give us some guidelines on how to determine that time. Basically, you need to calculate the halfway point between Fajr and Maghrib. And that halfway point would be the dahwatul kubra. Anytime before that, you can form the niyyah. Anytime after that, it's too late. You can't form the niyyah. It wouldn't work. So for example, if Fajr comes in at 5 a.m., and Maghrib comes in at 7 p.m., the Dahwatul Kubra is going to be at 12 p.m. because how many hours do you have there in the day? You have 14, so 7 and 5 is 12, 12 o'clock. If you form the niyyah before 12, you're good to go, right? And this only applies to the second kind of fasting, the current Ramadan fast, the specific vowed fast, where a day's been chosen already, and voluntary fast. However, it is better and easier to avoid all of this just by making sure you know exactly what you're doing the night before, which most people do, alhamdulillah, it's not really an issue. Have you ever in Ramadan gone to bed not knowing that the next day is Ramadan? I don't think it happens. Maybe in some person it would, but most people know exactly what's going on. And that intention to fast the next day is already formed. So there's no need to really worry yourself over articulating the niyyah, saying it out loud. But this is to distinguish various types of fasting and which has leeway and which does not have leeway in terms of forming the intention. So we come now to the things that break the fast. Because if fasting is imsak, if it's just withholding from food and drink and intercourse, from sunrise to sunset, right? Then we need to know, well, what are those things that would break that state of fasting? And these are called the muftirat. Now, there's different kinds of muftirat, and there's different rulings attached to them, because not everything that breaks the fast takes the same ruling. Some have stronger consequences than others. It all depends on what it is and the state of the person when it happens. So broadly, when you're talking about things that break the fast, you have those things that break the fast and require qada and kafara, that you have to make up the fast and you have to engage in the kafara, the expiation for breaking that fast. So every broken fast that is requiring makeup and expiation is involving making up the day and a penalty of some sort. But then you have those things that break the fast that only require that you make up the day after that Ramadan. So what are these and what's the difference? So make up and expiation. Now make up is basically a day after Ramadan, preferably from the month of Shawwal and before the next Ramadan. You're making up that day or those days. That's the qada. And the qada is required on anyone who breaks the fast according to these. Expiation is when, as you'll see, you're paying a penalty or you're engaging in a kind of fasting that is a penalty. So if a person eats or drinks something that humans would normally consume, and this consummation nourishes, medicates, or pleases the body in some way. So this is intentional eating or drinking of something that normally nourishes the body, right? So food, drink, coffee, whatever. This would not include a person intentionally taking sawdust, or as the fuqaha mentioned, hadid, metal. Why do they mention metal? Well, you think about it. Imagine a carpenter. They're working on a house. They're framing a house. And you often see them putting nails in their mouth to hold it as they're hammering. What happens if they swallow it? Right? Now, that's accidental, but they mention these examples. This is normal food and drink that a person takes and it nourishes, medicates, or pleases the body in some way. Or they engage in sexual intercourse, regardless if one ejaculated or not. Or they swallowed the saliva of one's spouse. Yeah, that's what they mentioned, because fiqh is for everybody, all sorts of people who get into all sorts of problems and don't really, we need to have all these details. The purpose here is that these things are all done on within, they're done purposely. They're not done out of forgetfulness. The expiation for these things, because this day has to be made up, but there's also an expiation. And that expiation is a way of atoning for the sin of purposely breaking your fast. Because if you purposely break your fast, it's a kabira, it's a major sin. And that major sin requires expiation that wipes away the effect of the sin. The expiation is to fast 60 consecutive days. That's the first level. So 60 days consecutively means you have to pick a time where there's no Eid coming up, right? And you have to make it's day one through what through 60 without any breaks whatsoever. The only exception would be for women in their menstrual cycle. But for men, it has to be straight 60 days expiation. And you have to choose a time when there's no Eid coming up. If a person does not fast them consecutively, let's say they fasted for 48 days, and on the 49th day, they stop fasting for whatever reason, they have to start all over again. So this is a punishment. This is a penalty by way the sin is wiped away. It's difficult. Now, if a person's unable to do that, they can't fast 60 days consecutively. There are other options mentioned in Sharia. If a person has relative certainty that they are physically unable to fast 60 days consecutively, then they have to either feed 60 poor people their fill for two meals, or feed one poor person to his fill for two meals a day for 60 days, or give 60 people half a sa'a of wheat or similar food grains, or its monetary value. You can calculate the value, the cost of that amount. Or give them 60 people a sa'a of dates or its monetary value. Or you give one poor person either C or D for 60 days. So a sa'a is about 2.2 kilograms. Some say 2.5 to be on the safe side. And this is a penalty, right? So the issue is, you start with fasting 60 days consecutively. Only if you're unable to do that would you go to one of these options. The point is, this is an expiation for the sin of purposely breaking the fast. What happens if a person missed many, many days of fasting? They purposely neglected fasting for many days or many Ramadans. The answer is they have to make up those days, of course. But they do one kafara and a general tawbah for those missed days. Because some people think that for every day they have to do this, therefore they calculate 5 or 6 years of no Ramadans. Each day is 29 or 30 days, and then each day is 60 days, like they're fasting the rest of their life. That's not how it works. You just do the kafara, or you do the qada, and you do the expiation in this manner. Now, inshallah, this won't happen to anyone. But we have to know how these things work in the event that it does happen, or we know someone in our family or circle to whom this has happened. Now, because fiqh is not just for pious religious people, it's also for people who sin, who err, who don't do the right thing. They also need to know how do they fix their errors from the past. So these are that's the kind of fasting that requires makeup and expiation. So the expiation is what we just described. But then you have things that break the fast, which require only that you make up the day, and doesn't require this kind of kafara. And this includes lots of different things that we've all been exposed to or we hear about. I have lots of lists here, and it's not fard ain knowledge to memorize these lists. You just need to know the basics of what breaks the fast and what doesn't, and figure out what to do if something happens accidentally versus on purpose. So if a person was to swallow something like rice, flour, a mouthful of salt or toothpaste, and it's not done out of forgetfulness, it's done accidentally. There's a big difference between forgetting and doing something accidentally, right? This is done, the person is aware that it's happened. They're not forgetting that they're fasting, right? So they accidentally swallow water during wudu or a shower. You know, when you're in the shower, if you lift your head up too high, the water can get into your nose and you feel it in your throat. You have to be very careful. Or if you're making wudu too vigorously as you're doing the istinshaq, you may sniff the water up into your nose and it goes so far that it's in the back of your throat and then you swallow it inadvertently. Eating on purpose after you ate forgetfully, right? So you ate and you forgot you're fasting, and then you mistakenly thought that because you forgot you were fasting and ate, that your fast is ruined, and then you start eating something after that. You're eating on purpose, but it's because you thought your fast was ruined by forgetfully eating. So you have a doubt there. It's not the same as knowing that you should be fasting and purposely breaking the fast without any legitimate reason. Such as also an orgasm from rubbing, kissing, touching, smoking, or inhaling smoke that you produced on, you know, incense smoke. If you eat a pea-sized amount of food stuck in your teeth, right? If it's less than that, it's nothing. So these are examples where you need to make up those days, but you don't have to pay the kafara or to fast the 60 days. Why? Because it was either done accidentally, you were aware that you were fasting, but it was done accidentally, or you did it purposely, but because you thought you did something wrong earlier that broke your fast, even though that was incorrect. So if you are fasting, most of us know this, if you're fasting, and you forget that you're fasting and you take a bite of something, what do you do? Do you say, oh, I ruined my fast, and you go ahead and eat the rest of the food? Or do you stop and continue fasting? What do you do? Stop. You continue fasting because you forgot. You forgot you were fasting. And this happens, especially in the kitchen when a person's preparing food and they want to taste something. They may forget they're fasting, especially if it's the beginning of Ramadan. But let's say a person, they forgot they were fasting, they tasted the dish, and as soon as they swallowed, they remembered, oh, I'm fasting. And be honest, this has happened to almost every one of you, hasn't it? It happens to most people. A person might imagine, this happened to me when I was a brand new Muslim, I remember. I this happened and I thought, oh, I put something in my body, so my fast is broken. Therefore, if my fast is broken, I could go ahead and eat something, can't I? I can go ahead and open the fridge and get out leftovers from last night's iftar. So now you're eating on purpose. But that's because you thought mistakenly that you had broken your fast when you didn't. So you are eating on purpose, but it's based on a shubha. It's a doubt. It's some faulty, mistaken understanding. So for that, you're going to make up the day later, but you're not paying the penalty. You're not doing the kafara, expiation, of fasting 60 days, because it's not the same thing as a purposeful sin, right? That's the distinction. If you eat a pea-sized amount of food that was stuck in your teeth, and they use these descriptions to give you a kind of dabit, a kind of guideline for what is seen as too much. Because people may eat suhoor, and they may have some bits of food stuck in between their teeth. Well, what happens if they're fasting, and an hour later, as they're talking, they realize a piece of food or whatever became dislodged from their teeth, and they swallowed it. The ulama say that if that was a small amount, less than the size of a chickpea, right, then it's nothing. It's so minuscule. But if it's the size of a chickpea or larger, that is a sufficient amount that you should notice very easily and be able to get rid of. Right? Less than that is hard to avoid. More than that is easy to avoid. But let's say you swallowed it because it was stuck there and you just got rid of it. That's not the same thing as purposely breaking your fast in the daytime of Ramadan and having a meal. So that you make up the day, but there's no penalty. There's lots of examples like this. Maybe I'll give you a few and you can help answer them. Eating or drinking something forgetfully. Actually, this doesn't break. These are the things that don't break the fast. Yes, okay. So things that are not muftirat, that don't break the fast. Eating or drinking something forgetfully, not accidentally. What's the difference? So forgetfully, we gave the scenario. You are cooking, it's day one of Ramadan. And as you're cooking, you taste the food, and as soon as you swallow it, you remember, oh, I'm fasting. That was forgetful. That doesn't require you to make up a fast, because your fast isn't broken in the first place. But let's say you're in the shower, and you tilt your head back, and the water goes into your nose, and then it goes down your throat, and you swallow it. You didn't intend for this to happen. It was an accident. Do you have to make that day up? What's the difference between scenario one, where you're in the kitchen, and scenario two, when you're in the shower? What's the essential difference?
Because accidentally, you know that it's not right.
Right, so you got in the shower, and you were aware that you're fasting. But while you were aware of your fasting, that accidentally entered your body. So that's different from forgetting that you're fasting. So we distinguish between forgetting and something happening accidentally. Right? Can you swim and fast at the same time? In the fiqh, in sharia, can you fast and swim?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, technically you can swim. Is it a safe thing to do? It's not. If you're a skilled swimmer and you can swim without swallowing or sniffing water that goes past your throat, then you can technically swim. But let's say, so if you're on the swim team, I guess you have to reconsider, right? But maybe you're in a place where you have to swim. There are Muslims in places like Bangladesh who, to get from one place to another, have to swim across streams, and they're fasting in Ramadan. So they have to swim. So what do? Well, they don't allow water to come into their body. But let's say, I don't know how that might happen, but let's say that you have waves and it splashes and they accidentally inhale the water and it goes into their body and they feel it. They didn't intend that. That's an accident. What do they do? Do they continue fasting or do they break their fast? Yeah, you keep fasting. But did that break their fast? Yes, it was accidental. So it wasn't done on purpose, but it did break the fast because they had a substance, this water, that went through a recognized body cavity, whether it's the nose or the mouth. And so they do make up that day, but they're not sinful for it. Now, the things that don't break the fast that are listed here are just to give you some ideas. Eating what is between the teeth, if it's less than the size of a chickpea. You know, what's so special about a chickpea, right? The idea is, when you're talking about things small and large, the scholars want to give you a guideline, a dabit, a kind of rule of thumb, so that you can apply it to things in your life. And so they determined that anything that is the size of a chickpea or larger should be easy to recognize when it's stuck in your mouth. I don't know about you, but if I had a chickpea in my mouth, I would feel it, I would know it's there, and I would get it out before the Adhan of Fajr. So if it's less than that, and it's hard to avoid especially, in between your teeth, and it is dislodged and you swallow it, that's not breaking your fast, right? Dust or smoke, including smoke from incense, entering your throat without one's doing. So let's say you go into a place and there's smoke or dust, even if it's incense smoke, and you inhale it, you're breathing it in, but you're not purposely bringing it into your nose. You're not sniffing it, and you're not opening your mouth trying to inhale it. It just happens to, the wafts of smoke or incense blow over you. That's not breaking your fast. Now, if you were to purposely inhale that smoke, that would be something of a substance. It's a substance entering a recognized body cavity, your mouth or your nose. That would be problematic. And that's why if you smoke cigarettes, you can't smoke in Ramadan, because that would break your fast, right? As opposed to just passively inhaling smoke or dust as you're walking through an alleyway or somewhere. Chewing on a sesame seed without swallowing it if its taste doesn't reach the throat. Now, I don't know if any of you plan on taking sesame seeds and chewing on them while fasting. I wouldn't advise it. But the idea here is, if something small is in your mouth and you chew it and it has a flavor, as long as you're not swallowing that, then that in itself isn't going to break the fast. But if you swallow it and it has flavor, okay, now you have a problem. Like chewing gum, the fuqaha mentioned al-ilk, which is an old kind of chewing gum from back in the day, which was made of frankincense, or it was made of different substances. It was a resin, and they would use it for strengthening their memory. They would use it to various purposes. The old ilk, or chewing gum from hundreds of years ago, had no sugar, it had no flavoring, it had no other substances that would break down. It would be like, you know, in our day and age, just chewing plastic or something, or just chewing something flavorless. They allowed chewing that, but you're not allowed to chew gum and swallow whatever is produced within the saliva from the chewing gum, because that has flavors, it has sugar, it has some nutritious content that you're then swallowing, right? A mosquito, fly, or any other object entering one's throat without one's doing. I remember reading the hadith about what happens if a fly lands in a drink. The hadith says that you dip the fly into the thing and you pull it out. And I always wondered, you know, growing up here, I never saw any flies landing into bodies of water, like glasses of water or glasses of tea. Until I went overseas and I encountered the flies there, and I realized, yes, when they talk about this stuff, it's because it's a lived experience. Is it possible for a mosquito or fly to enter one's throat without one's doing? Absolutely. It happened to me in Yemen. I was talking in class, and next thing you know, a fly just went like this, and I had to spit it out. And then you realize how relevant the fiqh texts are to everyday life. Because if I was fasting, God forbid you swallow it. But, you know, you need to know. Swallowing the wetness that remains after washing one's mouth for wudu or ghusl. Because if you're making wudu, you're taking ghusl, and you're taking the water into your mouth, it's obvious that even though you're spitting that water out, there may be something that remains within the inner parts of the gums and around the inner part of the mouth. But you're not collecting that. As long as you're spitting out whatever needs to be spat out, if any remaining moisture from the water is there, there's no harm if that's swallowed. Likewise, if you swallow one or two drops of sweat or tears that enter the mouth and mix with one saliva, on the condition that one cannot taste the saltiness. Because if you taste the saltiness and that goes past your throat, that is something with nutritional value entering a recognized orifice. So again, you go back to that definition of a substance that provides some nutrition entering a recognized orifice or body cavity. So these are some examples. We'll go through these quickly. Swallowing one's own saliva doesn't break the fast. Swallowing one's own phlegm after clearing the throat. You know, if you cough, you have that phlegm, you're not required to spit that out if you're fasting. You could swallow that. It's not going to break your fast. Swallowing vomit. I don't know why anyone would do that, but it may happen accidentally. Swallowing vomit that emerges in the mouth without one's doing, even if it's a mouthful. And any more than that, no. Now, this may happen if a person's eaten something that has upset their stomach, you know. They're fasting, and because the stomach is upset, maybe they belch and regurgitate something. What do? Are they required to spit that out? If it's less than a mouthful or up to a mouthful, even if they swallowed that just as a reaction, you know, instinctually, that would not break the fast. Deliberately vomiting less than a mouthful, regardless if one swallows it or not. Using a miswak or toothbrush. What about toothpaste? Can you brush your teeth with toothpaste?
No.
Hmm?
No.
You know, technically, you could use toothpaste if you don't swallow it, but it's very hard to avoid that because it has flavor. So you should just avoid it. Use the miswak or use a dry toothbrush and then just spit out whatever you do. Wetting one's lips with saliva while speaking and swallowing that. Swallowing blood that exits from the gums and does not preponderate over the saliva. What does that mean? It means, let's say a person has an issue with their gums. It's very common. And maybe they use the miswak or in any situation, they have a gum issue and they start to bleed. If they swallowed that, would it break their fast? It depends on how much blood is there. If the saliva outweighs the content of blood, that's fine. It doesn't break the fast. But if it's more, the ratio of blood to saliva has blood dominate over the saliva, or it's majority blood, if you swallow that, that would break your fast. So this would be a person who maybe they get hit and they're bleeding inside of their mouth, and the blood is more than the saliva. Don't swallow that. Now, you're hearing all of these things, and you're wondering, well, how could that ever happen to me? But you may be like me, sitting there somewhere in the desert when a fly flies into your mouth. You never know. So we cover these scenarios. And lastly, backbiting does not break the fast. Now, there's some people who think it does. It does spoil the reward of fasting, but it doesn't break the fast itself, requiring one to make it up. Now, there's so many other things, right? Sniffing up mucus in the nose, applying kuhul in the eyes, dripping eye drops or contact solution in the eyes, watering entering the ears from a bath, rubbing oil or cream on the body or hair. Let's look at that one for a second, because when you understand how the rules work, you can answer these questions without even knowing like specifics. Okay, let's say you have coconut oil. Does your skin absorb coconut oil? Does your skin absorb oils in general? Yes. The skin is one of the largest organ. you apply anything and the skin will absorb it. So what is the difference between drinking water, or let's say drinking coconut oil that you've warmed up, that you've swallowed, and putting it on your skin, which your body then absorbs? What's the essential difference between the two? Both of them into your body. Why does one break your fast and the other doesn't? Very good. In order for it to break your fast, it has to enter a manfad mu'tabar, what they call a recognized bodily cavity, right? And you have two main ones, the mouth and the nose. And you have the ears too, if done purposely. And even in the private areas, if done purposely, there's details about that. But if you, okay, let's say you apply ointment to a wound, or like coconut oil to your skin, is that going to break your fast? No, even if your body absorbs it, because it is not coming into your body through a recognized bodily cavity. So let's say a person has a wound in their stomach and they apply some medicine that reaches into the stomach itself. Would that break the fast? It would, because that's entering into the bodily cavity, not through a recognized orifice, but it reaches the jowf, the inner parts of the stomach. And I would argue that if you have to apply a medicine that's going right into your stomach from a very large wound, you shouldn't be fasting, you should be in the hospital. So it's unlikely to ever happen. So surface wounds, an ointment, or lotions, or creams, even though these things are absorbed in the body, they're not coming through a normal orifice, they're not going to break your fast. And there's nothing wrong with applying them. Likewise, the fuqaha say, if you're hot and it's summertime, you can take a bath, you can cool off, you can moisturize yourself in various ways, as long as those substances are not entering the bodily cavities that would cause it to break your fast. Applying deodorant, same thing. Withdrawing blood, such as a blood test. And what about vaccinations? Would those break your fast? What about insulin? Let's say a person has diabetes. Would that break their fast if they take the insulin shots? They would need that, yeah. Well, what if their doctor clears them for fasting, provided they take their insulin shots? But the insulin shot, where is it being taken? Where is the insertion? It's here, right? It's not, is it entering a recognized cavity? No. So even if it has nutritional value, like the insulin, even then it's not going to break the fast as long as it's not entering al-manfad al-mu'tabar, the recognized bodily cavity. What about a person who has asthma and they need to take an inhaler? Will that break the fast? Yes. Why? Because it has a substance. It's not oxygen on its own. It has a substance to it, and it's entering past the throat, going in through a recognized cavity. That breaks the fast. So if you have asthma and you're required to use the inhaler daily, whether inhaler, nebulizer, whatever, then these things are breaking your fast. So you would be paying the fidya. You wouldn't be fasting on those days. I'll backtrack that a little bit and say that you would make up those days. The fidya depends if it's a lifelong illness. Now, there are certain things that are disliked when fasting. They don't spoil the fast, but we shouldn't do them. Tasting or chewing something without an excuse, provided that its flavor is not swallowed. So one could do this, but it's better not to, because there's a risk. Chewing flavorless gum, kissing with desire, in which one fears falling into sexual intercourse or ejaculation, on the condition one did not swallow the other's saliva, gathering saliva in the mouth and then swallowing it. I don't know why anyone would do that, but it's makruh. to gargle excessively when making wudu or ghusl for fear of breaking the fast. The hadith of the Prophet ﷺ describes this, and he cautions us that when we're fasting, to be careful when sniffing the water into our nose and when gargling. That you don't want to take it so far up into your nasal passage that it goes past and into your throat. Just do it moderately as you're making wudu. Just lightly, so it's in the front part, not going all the way up. To sniff it, but if you did more than that, as long as it's not going to your throat, your fast is good, but it's preferred that you don't do it. To sniff water excessively when cleaning the nose in wudu or ghusl for fear of breaking the fast. Likewise, doing things that would weaken one while fasting, like cupping or withdrawing blood. It is makruh, it is disliked in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa for a person to deliberately do things while fasting that will weaken them, because there's a fear that in that state of weakness they may be required to break their fast due to something that they didn't need to do. So cupping will weaken you. Usually when you get cupped, the hijama, you usually want to eat something right after that to replenish you. Withdrawing blood, and likewise exercise. There are a lot of people who have a very strict exercise routine and they go to the gym regularly, which is good. However, they push themselves so much in Ramadan to keep the gains that they end up depleting themselves to the point where they feel they have to break the fast. That is makruh. And if you know you can do it, go ahead and do it. And if you're into that, there's different techniques and strategies for maintaining your fitness in Ramadan, even though it should be a lesser priority. Brushing the teeth with toothpaste or using mouthwash on the condition that one does not swallow it, you shouldn't do this, it's too risky. If you know that you can do it without swallowing anything or having that flavor reach the throat, fine. But if you're brushing your teeth very vigorously and, you know, covering all the areas, it's very risky because you're reaching the back of your mouth. So better to leave that. Now here we come to a few issues that pertain to women in fasting and other people who are sick, or breastfeeding women and travelers. These are the people who are excused from fasting. And again, this is fard ayn knowledge. Not that you have to have these lists memorized, but you have to know the basics of who is required and who is not required and what are the conditions of these. So menstruating women are obviously excused from fasting. They make up those days. Women in a state of nifas or postnatal bleeding after giving birth, they are also excused from fasting. And sick people who fear that the illness will worsen or be prolonged. But this is not based on a person's own subjective feelings. Oh, I have a headache, I'm gonna break my fast. I saw a meme yesterday. It was the doggy meme. And the one dog has a sword and a helmet, and it says, "We fasted in battle hundreds of years ago." And then there's a little puny dog saying, I want to break my fast because I have a test today. You know, just showing you the people back then, they would not break their fast for silly reasons or minor difficulties. So you have to be sick, but fear that your sickness will be worsened or prolonged. But that is determined by an upright Muslim doctor or by previous experiences of actual harm you had in the past. Not just an assumption that it's going to be hard. You can't just assume. You need to have some experience of that in the past or from an upright, skilled Muslim doctor. If a woman is breastfeeding or pregnant, she is allowed to break her fast, or she's allowed to abstain from fasting when there's genuine difficulty and a real fear, again, based on prior experience, or the testimony of an upright doctor. If she knows that she can breastfeed and the child will be fed adequately and she will not be harmed by fasting while breastfeeding, she is required to fast even though she's breastfeeding. But if through previous experiences she knows that it's a major difficulty, or that it's a harm to her health in the long term, or it depletes her milk supply, which is a harm to the child, she would not fast on those days. But again, it goes back to experience or the testimony of an upright Muslim doctor. If a person is traveling, they are allowed, they're excused from fasting as long as it's beyond 81 kilometers, which is the standard for when a person is considered a traveler. And they initiated the journey at the onset of Fajr. So if you are, say you're here, and Fajr comes in, it's Ramadan, Fajr comes in, you have to fast that day. If you're going to travel later on, you still have to keep that fast, right? So this would be a person who is traveling and Fajr hasn't come in, or they've reached the destination before Fajr, or it's the day after they arrived and the next day and they're on the road, they don't have to fast. But if you have a road trip to take and you wake up, you take your suhoor and you're fasting because you're resident, and then at 10 o'clock in the morning you board your flight, even though you're a traveler, you still have to keep that fast because you opened it while you were resident, right? So let's go now to the fidya. The fidya in the Hanafi school is different from the others. Because in the other schools, if you have fast to make up and you didn't make them up in time for the next Ramadan, you would pay a fidya, this kind of penalty. But in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, it works a little differently. This is a special kind of sadaqah that you give to poor people, where you pay for each day of missed fast in Ramadan. So you're paying the 2.2 kilograms of wheat, which is the sa'a. And in the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, this is only paid by a person who cannot fast at all, meaning they can't fast in Ramadan, they don't have the ability to make up the previous fast they've missed any time of the year because of medical conditions, and they have no reason to believe that they will ever regain the ability to fast in future Ramadans. This is a person who has a very serious chronic condition, or due to their age and condition, they receive the advice of their Muslim physician that you cannot fast because it will worsen your pre-existing conditions. That person is not going to be able to make up the fast because they don't expect to get better from the chronic condition. That's the only kind of person who's going to pay fidya. Other people, they're not paying the fidya. They're making up the days. And let's say they have 5 days of the past Ramadan to make up, and the next Ramadan rolls around and they didn't make up those days. What do? Well, they still have to make them up after that Ramadan. There's nothing else for them to do but to make them up. In the other madahib, in that scenario, you still have to make them up, and you have to pay fidya, right? And this happens a lot with mothers. It happens with mothers because they have one child, two children, three children. They're missing fast in Ramadan, either due to pregnancy, late stage pregnancy, or during their the nifas period, the postpartum period. And because they have a second child and a third child and they're breastfeeding, one Ramadan rolls into the next and there's days missed that they didn't get to make up from the previous Ramadans. So in the other schools, they have to make up those days and pay the fidya for each of those days. They have to calculate. In the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, there's a leniency here where you just have to make the days up and that's it. The only person who pays fidya is a person who does not ever expect to recover from their condition. The ulama do say that if they expected that they would never recover, but then somehow they recovered, well, now you got to make those days up. So if, imagine a person who has a kind of condition where they've missed 5 years of fasting and they just pay the fidya every year, but in year six, whether it's a miracle or some breakthrough cure, who knows, is gone. The condition is gone. Well, now they're in a position to actually make up the fast, and they make them up. وَلَا يُكَلِّفُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا. Okay, to go quickly through some of this material, recommended things to eat the suhoor before Fajr. One shouldn't miss the suhoor if they can. To delay the suhoor until closer to Fajr. So if Fajr comes in at 4:30, don't eat your suhoor at 2:30. It's better to eat it at 4, right? You can stop eating at a period of time shortly before Fajr to be on the safe side, but you don't want to have it so early. That's less preferable. To hasten to break the fast after the entering of Maghrib. There's no virtue in knowing that Maghrib has entered and remaining in a state of fasting 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes after Maghrib. You break your fast and you go pray Maghrib and you come back and have your dinner. That's recommended. Now we'll go through the miscellaneous issues quickly. Some of these, you have the slides, so you can go back to these to review. The first one I may glance through very quickly. A person may get sick and they miss fast, and during that period they die. So they're missing fast and they die from the sickness. That person isn't required to tell their family, listen, I need these days, the fidya to be paid on my behalf after I die. They don't have to do that. But if he gets sick and then gets better and didn't have a chance to make up the days, then the family would pay fidya on his behalf. Should that ever happen to you, you may forget this, but you should be aware and return to it should that ever happen in your life. If you have many days to make up in Ramadan, or past Ramadans, it's preferable to make them up one after the other. So if you have 10 days, knock them out 10 days in a row. But if you can't, you can split them up, that's also fine. And if you take too long, you fast the next Ramadan, and then do the makeups later, there's no fidya, as we said. Now, those who get the fidya, who are the people who receive the food items, whether it's grain or dates, or the monetary value, who receives that? The ulama say, the masariful fidya, masariful zakat. Those who receive the fidya in food or monetary form are the same people who receive zakat. So it's not just anybody, not some random Muslim you don't know. You need to verify this person is among the fuqara, the masakeen, or the other categories of those who can receive zakat. And it can be given to one person or many, that's fine. If you start a voluntary fast and you break it, you have to make it up, even though it's voluntary. By starting the voluntary fast, you've made it incumbent on you to finish it. And if you broke it, you would have to make it up. So in origin, it's recommended, but making it up is wajib. When might that happen? Well, let's say you have a voluntary fast. You decide, okay, well, this Sunday I'm going to fast. And then relatives come over unexpectedly, and you have to cook for them and you get some food. It would be rude, perhaps, for you to keep the fast. They may be offended. You can break the fast in that situation to entertain guests. You just need to make the day up. If a child reaches puberty, or someone takes shahada in the daytime, they stop eating, but they don't have to make up that day. If someone is unconscious in the daytime, they don't make up that day, but they make up subsequent days, they remain unconscious. These scenarios are unlikely to happen in our lives, but they do happen. If an insane person gains their sanity, they make up the days of Ramadan missed due to the insanity, and they fast the rest, because the insanity is kind of like a medical condition, and now it's lifted, they make those days up. But while they are insane, there's no fasting required on them. Injections don't break the fast, as we said. Inhalers do, because they enter the throat. And last week we mentioned the nicotine patches. Now maybe you can answer the question for us. Would a nicotine patch put on the skin break one's fast? Yes or no? According to the school of Imam Abu Hanifa, it would not break the fast to put on a nicotine patch. Why? Exactly. Because the nicotine patch, whatever it's secreting, whatever the body's absorbing of nicotine, is not entering min manfad mu'tabar, from a recognized orifice. And there's a quote that talks about this here from Imam al-Kasani in Bada'i' al-Sana'i', a Hanafi fiqh text. These are miscellaneous issues that come up. Now here's a couple of important things for women. If the hayd starts in Ramadan during the night time, which is any time after Maghrib until Fajr, she refrains from fasting the following day for the duration of the period. That's very obvious, everyone knows that. If it starts during the day, the period starts during the daytime of Ramadan, that fast is broken because the period started. And she has to make up that day, and she has to refrain from fasting for the duration that she is menstruating. She has to make that day up. If the menstruation stops during the night, then she performs the ghusl, begins the salawat, she has to pray, and she fasts the next day. Very obvious. And if the period stops in the daytime, okay, so this is, if it's 7, 8, 10 days, right? Let's say the period ends on the 10th day, well, she's not fasting. She had breakfast, she had lunch, she's drinking tea, but then she has tuhur, she takes the ghusl, she is now praying her salawat. What does she do? She performs the ghusl, she begins the ibadat, and from that moment forward, for the rest of the day, she behaves as if she's fasting, even though she's not. So she may have had a breakfast and a lunch and a tea, but from that moment where her period is done, she behaves as if she's fasting, even though she's not, even though that day has to be made up. Because of hurmatu shahr, the sacredness and sanctity of the month of Ramadan, she abstains from these things for the rest of that day. So a few hours or whatnot. But she can't count that as a fast, obviously. I'tikaf, because we're going over the time. The i'tikaf is fard kifaya, generally speaking. It is to retreat in the masjid, to spend the night in the masjid. And there's three types of i'tikaf in the Hanafi school. You have the one that's wajib, and that's if you take a vow. You say, Wallahi, I swear by Allah, I will do i'tikaf for 3 days in Ramadan. I met a man many years ago. He took a vow he would do i'tikaf in the Haram Sharif in Mecca for 15 years. And he kept it. He was a local man of Yemeni origin. And apparently, he told the story. He said he had a huge problem in his family. And he took an oath by Allah that if this situation is fixed, he would do i'tikaf for 15 years. Now, I wouldn't advise that, but he did it. And subhanAllah, I met him, he was in his 70s, and he was going strong, like probably like 12 years into it. It was amazing. But that's mandatory. You have the i'tikaf, which is an emphasized communal sunnah, meaning it's a sunnah upon the community. I think I said fard kifaya. I don't mean fard kifaya as an obligation, but as like a sunnah kifaiya, a collective sunnah that the community, at least a sufficient number, should do in the community. And that's particularly in the last 10 nights of Ramadan. And then you have recommended i'tikaf, which is any other time. In the Hanafi school, if you vow to do i'tikaf, it has to be in conjunction with fasting. And you can't leave the i'tikaf area except for a legitimate need, such as using the bathroom, an emergency, and so on. And it's only valid in the masjid. You can't do i'tikaf in your house as a man. As a woman, you can do i'tikaf in your house, but not as a man. It has to be in the masjid. And lastly, it is permissible to eat and drink in the masjid during itikaf. We have hadith to that effect. These are just basic points of itikaf that we should know. And it is a communal sunnah. So you should have people doing it in the community as an emphasized sunnah every Ramadan in the last 10 nights. Now, we come to the final part, and this is actually worth an entire class, the spiritual dimensions of fasting. A person may cross all their T's and dot all their I's in the fiqh of fasting by refraining from having anything enter their recognized orifices from the time of Fajr until the time of Maghrib with an intention from those permitted to fast. They fulfill all of the conditions for a valid fast in the Sharia outwardly. But inwardly, there's other aspects that may or may not be there. And these are the spiritual dimensions that we want to adhere to as best as we can for a more complete fast. And that's fasting with the eyes from the haram, fasting with the ears from the haram and the idle things, fasting with the tongue from gossip and backbiting and uselessness, and fasting with one's heart from distractions. If a person was to engage with their eyes, ears, tongue, or heart in things that are blameworthy, is their fast still valid in Sharia? Yes, because they didn't eat anything, but it diminishes the reward. So you have what we've just described in all of these slides is really the bare minimum of an accepted fast in the fiqh. Because the fiqh is concerned with the outward, but the inward is what's going on inside your heart. Fasting with the eyes, the ears, the tongue, the heart, and these levels really bring the fast to something that is alchemical in a sense, and that it transforms and changes you. If you just adhere to the fiqh without thinking of these matters or working with them, you may have an accepted fast while you're engaging in gossip, while you're looking at things and listening to things that are blameworthy. Because the idea of fasting is imsak, holding back, restraint. So you're blocking the senses, not just of taste, but also of sight and hearing. So if you have, you know, bad habits, things that come into your ears or eyes that shouldn't, Ramadan is definitely the time to make a plan to get rid of those during the month. So you're fasting not just with your stomach and your mouth, your orifices, but also your other senses. If you do that, you'll find, number one, it's challenging. But number two, if you do it, it enhances the fast because you're already more spiritually sensitive. So it's Imam Ghazali, and I'll leave you with this. He gives the example of this. He says it's like, imagine you have a pond. I'll take a modern twist on Imam Ghazali's analogy. Imagine you have a pond located next to a factory. And the factory produces toxic waste substances and all this sludge. And the sludge streams down into this pond. There's no fish in the pond. They're all dead. You can't swim in it. You can't drink the water. And you want to make it a pure pond. What do? Well, it has all this toxic sludge. If you go into the pond and you get your shovel and you start shoveling it out, okay, good and well. You need to get it out. But there's a problem here. What's the problem? The stream bringing the sludge in from the factory is still there. So as much as you dig out, there's more coming in. So if you want to get the sludge out, what do you need to do first? You need to stop the stream. Block that stream coming from the factory. Once you block the stream, you can then dig out all the sludge. And once you've dug that out, then you can start to regenerate life in the pond. So eventually there's fish and you could drink from it. So the pond is like the heart. And the stream of toxic waste would be the stream coming through the senses. So you have a stream through the eyes going into the heart. A stream starting from the ears going into the heart. If you are fasting, but those streams are bringing toxic waste, spiritual waste, yes, you're fasting, but if you really want to get the benefit, you need to cut out those streams, block them, block those senses from those blameworthy things, and then you can move the sludge out as you're fasting. If you take that analogy and think about it as you come into Ramadan, you have a really great gift for receiving the month in the best way possible. So may Allah Ta'ala allow us to reach Ramadan in a state that is pleasing to Him. And may Allah accept from you your study of these Fard Ayn matters. And we will reconvene after Ramadan with what we need to know about purification and prayer. Wallahu a'lam wa sallallahu wa sallama ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam.